Okay. I am Harlan, as Nancy just told you, and I am a very compulsive overeater. And I live in Scottsdale, Arizona. If you've ever been to Scottsdale, Arizona, that's where I live. But as you'll hear, that I was born and raised in Chicago, and that's very, very much a part of my story, and it's very much a part of who I am. I couldn't really help but be a compulsive overeater. There was really no escaping it for me, I guess. My mother was a very compulsive overeater. My father was a very compulsive overeater. My mother had a lot of mental and emotional problems, and on the day that I was born, my mother had no clue that she was even pregnant. She had no idea that she was pregnant, and when she called the doctor that morning, she was complaining about these pains that wouldn't go away, and the doctor said, "It really sounds to me like a kidney stone, but you better just get down here and I'll meet you here." And I was a kidney stone. And my mom and dad, my dad was 54 years old when I was born, and my mom and my dad did the best they could. In our adult years together, which was obviously later, in our adult years together, we were about 1,100 pounds between three adults. I was about 500 pounds at the time they passed, and they were about 300 pounds apiece in our life together when I was older. My dad was 54, as I said, when I was born, and my dad came to this country under horrific conditions. My father came to this country at a time when the world had gone crazy. His entire family was obliterated off the face of the earth, and he and one sister of eight children, parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins survived unbelievable things, unspeakable things, things that you should never know from or hear about in your life ever again. But it marked him and it scarred him, and he was not a person who coped well with different things. He did the best he could. When I was a kid, my dad told me every single day of my life, "I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you." My mom would tell me every single day of my life, "I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you." And all I really wanted to do was find out how the Flintstones ended that day. I was like 3 or 4 years old at that time. And at a very early age, I became my mother's husband and my father's wife. Not in a sexual sense at all. But they confided in me and they spoke to me, but not really to each other. And when they would be home together, there'd be pots and pans flying through the air and screaming and yelling and fighting constantly. My house was a battleground. My house was a war zone all the time. There was only one time when that house was at peace. There was only one time when there was all quiet on the Western Front. And the only time that that house was quiet was when there was massive, and I mean massive, quantities of food on the table. For us, a meal was just a break between grazing and snacks. We would eat right up to the time that the meal was served, and as soon as the meal was over, we would begin picking at things and eating and eating, and this went on all night. And I was really scared. I was really scared because I knew that this was not right. And from a very early age on, if there was anything that I could have been, it would have been someone else. If there was any life I could have had, it would have been someone else's life. I was positive that if I had Rob and Laura Petrie as parents, or if I had, you know, someone else's house or whatever, everything would just be perfect and I wouldn't have to live in this craziness anymore. And when I was a little kid, I was not one of those people who you hear about in program, or maybe you are one of those people who woke up one day and said, "Gee, I'm 27 or I'm 33 and I'm having a weight problem. Food has been an issue. Weight has been an issue for as far back as I can possibly remember. When I was a little boy of 3, 4, 5 years old, I remember people yelling and screaming at my mother, "How could you let him eat this way? What's the matter with you? What are you feeding this kid?" And they would yell and scream at my dad. My dad spoke very broken, very little English, but they'd be yelling and screaming at my father, "What's wrong with you? Why are you letting him eat candy? Why are you letting him eat all this stuff?" And eventually I got to the age where they started yelling and screaming at me. There were things that they would tell me that I just didn't understand how I could get from where I was and who I was to who they wanted me to be. They told me things like, "Don't eat so much, you'll feel better." They said to me, "Girls don't like fat boys." I found that to be true. They told me things like, "If you lose this amount of weight, 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 50 pounds, whatever that is, I'll buy you this, or I'll do this, or I'll do that for you." And I wanted to achieve the goals that they gave me. And they gave me sage advice. Sage advice. They'd say, "Just push yourself away from the table." This was brilliant stuff. I mean, this was tremendous stuff. And I didn't know how to explain to them. I didn't know how to tell them because I was a child. I didn't even know it as an adult either, but I certainly didn't know it when I was that young. "I wish I could be like you. I wish I had your strength. I wish I had what you seem to call upon so easily." And what I saw them doing was something I could not do. I thought and hoped and prayed that maybe one day I could do it, but I couldn't. And what I could not do was I could not just stop like they were telling me to do. There was something inside of me that focused on food in a way that was different. I didn't know it was different at that time because I was a kid. I thought everybody was really hooked into the food and really thinking about food all the time. Because you see, there were only two states of mind for me as a child. Or as an adult, if I'm not in recovery, but certainly as a child. I was either eating or not eating. In other words, I was completely hammering tongs into the food, or I was hanging from the chandelier like an ornament, not eating. I was busy using the most useless tool I have, my unaided willpower. Usually at that time it was born out of fear. And the fear was I was with somebody that was unusually abusive to me about my weight and I didn't want to eat in front of them. And things would start happening to me which were to escalate later, like people would walk up to me and they'd say, "Is that on your diet, young man? Or maybe you shouldn't have cake. Or why don't I cut you a really small piece because I know you're on a diet. Thanks." When I was about 8 years old, my mother took me to the doctor, and my mother was, she didn't know what to do with me any more than she knew what to do with herself. And she took me to the doctor, and the well-intentioned physician when I was 8 gave me diet pills. He gave me 500 milligrams of an amphetamine, which I took 3 times a day. I was on 1,500 milligrams of amphetamine at age 8. And I would use sleep about 15 minutes a month. And the diet pills work. And even though I'm 54 now, I can still feel my temples throbbing in my head. I would be getting in fights at school. The teacher would be talking, and all I would be hearing was like Charlie Brown, bark, 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 you know. Or I'd say the same thing 35 times, which some of you will accuse me of today. But, you know, you kind of hear yourself saying the, like, and I'm thinking, why am I saying this again? But you just can't help it. You know the thing. But when the pills wore off, I would eat Illinois and most of Wisconsin. And I did lose weight. And everybody said to me, "Don't you feel better now?" Yeah, I guess. But anyway, when I was 9, some of the information, not all, but some of the information on some of these amphetamines started coming out. And what they very simply did was they moved me from a pink pill to a blue pill, and instead of 500 milligrams, it was 250 milligrams, and you took 4 of them a day. Exactly the same effect. It did kill your appetite along with everything else in your life. You could not be present in the room at any given moment. I was there, but I was not there. And I see some heads going up and down. When I was a kid, and certainly when I was older, I tried it all. At one point in my life, a little bit later, I was a Topps king. Topps, I don't know if you guys know from Topps. Weight Watchers, I was a Weight Watchers king as a teenager. They brought me down to the Pitt Congress Hotel on Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and I was a Weight Watchers king, and they had the ribbon, and I looked like Miss Illinois, and they strutted me down the runway, and I was a Weight Watchers king. Lose weight with AIDS. Some of you remember those little candies, AYDS, which is sadly profound when you think about that today, but it was lose weight with AIDS, and there was, I think, Metrical or something else that we used, stuff out of a can, and, you know, there was the old stand on your head and twirl your foot around diet and all kinds of other things. I tried it all, but there was always something that happened, and it was the same. And what would happen is I would hunker down on unaided willpower, usually inspired by fear, sometimes inspired by a crush on a girl, sometimes inspired by just, I just didn't want to be this way anymore. And I would hunker down, and for a very short period of time, although it didn't seem short at the time, I would not eat. And I mean, I would not eat. But eventually what would happen is I would start eating again. And I always went on the damn bonus plan. Lose 50, gain 90. Lose 90, gain 140. All I wanted to sort of do was kind of get back to where I was, and I always passed it by, you know? And there was something about this life of mine I just couldn't get. I didn't understand for the life of me why, once I started eating certain things, I could not stop. Why, once I began eating certain things, I actually wanted them more after having started eating them than I did before. And I did not understand a lot of other things, namely, I didn't really understand that the other people in my environment were not stronger than me. I didn't understand that they weren't better than me or something that I am right on top of my poor friend Len here. I didn't understand that they weren't thinking about food like I was, and that they weren't focusing in on the food like I was. They were thinking about other things, like when we were a kid and we would go to the birthday party, they were really thinking about pinning the tail on the donkey. But I was thinking about, oh, is that the guy's mother with the cake or the ice cream? Or I'd be totally focused on the food. And I just assumed that they were too. And once I started eating the ice cream, or once I started eating the cake, there was something else I just assumed that they did too. I don't know if you did this, but I bet you did if you're anything like me. No matter how much food you serve me, I look past it. And what do I mean by that? Let's say you served me a piece of cake that's as big as this table. Immediately, what's going to happen in my mind is I'm going to write that off as not being enough, and I'm going to start looking around to see whose cake I can snarf when they get tired of theirs. And so I'm not only going to eat this piece of cake, I see a lot of heads going up and down. Okay, I'm not only going to eat this piece of cake, I'm going to get a little of his, and I'm going to get a little of his, and when he goes to the bathroom or he's playing tag with him or something, I'm going to eat their cake too. So no matter what you serve me, I look right past it as being inadequate. I see some heads. Okay. When I got older, it really started to accelerate in terms of the pain, in terms of my utter inability to control what was going on in my life. And when I started to get to be a teenager and I started to feel those feelings and I started to get in touch with some of that stuff and how I knew that there was a bridge that I needed to cross to get to the other side, and the bridge was having a much thinner body. And the more I tried to cross that bridge, the more I tried to overcome that chasm, the worse things got. Because a very dear friend of mine once told me something that stayed with me. And he said to me, once you begin trying to control something, it is by definition beyond your control at that point. So I was trying to control something, and there was no way that I could control it. And I was doing that over and over and over again. When I got to be older, now my mom's greatest ambition in life, my mother's greatest ambition in life, and this is something she talked about every day, was to become an invalid and die. This is what she wanted. And she had been hospitalized many, many times. She wasn't suicidal in that, but she really didn't. She had given up. But she was a very sick person. She was on. She was a diabetic, and she had lots of mental health problems, but lots of physical health problems too. Dialysis just ate her up, and she was an amputee from diabetes at the end of her life, and it was not a very pretty picture. And when my friends were doing things like getting ready to go to college away from home and going to universities and campus life and stuff, that was not to be for me, because I had elderly parents. The other reason it was not to be for me either was this. I tested well in school but didn't do well in school because I wasn't really there. And when I say I wasn't really there, I was very uncomfortable in my desk. I was very uncomfortable in my skin. I was very uncomfortable in my clothes. And I also wanted to look like the other kids. You know how you hear, like, in the 60s, everybody wanted to do their own thing? You know? Not me. Heck no. I just wanted to be another bozo on the bus. I wanted to wear Levi's and Madras shirts and look like the other kids. That's all I really wanted to do. And if you hear people say, well, if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. I remember everything. I wish I could forget some of it. But I remember everything. And when I was 22 years of age, my mom finally did die. And I was in college. And when I was 24 years old, my dad died. My dad had cancer. My dad, he ate everything he wanted to eat. He was a very, very, very heavy smoker. And he died of lung cancer that ransacked him. So when I was 24 years of age, I was alone. I do not have brothers and sisters. I don't have cousins, aunts, uncles, anything like that. I don't have grandparents, anything like that. But I do believe that God in His infinite wisdom never closes one door without opening up yet another door. I had good friends, and a little later on today I'm going to be talking about how all of you figure into that as well too. But I was very alone at age 24, and my food habit really escalated. I was in trouble. I was in trouble. And I had to move out of the apartment that my mom and dad and I lived in for almost 30 years. And I couldn't pay the rent. I was writing bad checks to anyone that would take them. I lied when the truth was better. My food habit in the 1970s was about $100 to $150 per day. I robbed Peter to rob Paul. I wrote bad checks, as I said. I passed checks on my dead father's bank account. I traded on his name with people that had done business with my dad since he came to this country. I wrote bad checks to people that knew my dad in the old country. I did whatever I had to do. I became everything at that time in my life that I detested and looked down upon as a human being. I became a criminal because I did not pay my taxes and I wrote bad checks. I became a liar. I became a thief. I became everything I detested in a person. A person who could not be relied upon. I thought of myself as a good, nice person, but my actions didn't speak to that most of the time. I had good intentions, but they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But the world was judging me by my actions. I lived in filth. I lived in squalor. I lived in shame. I hid from the landlord. I did everything I could do to survive that day. And I had two fears. The one fear I had was that you were going to come and take away my food. And the other fear that I had was that somehow you were going to comment about what I was eating. And those were the fears that I lived in. That somehow, some way, even though I was absolutely enormous, I could get past you and you wouldn't notice me. That was what I wanted. And I also wanted to make sure, before I let you pass, if you had any money or any food that I could get from you, well, then I was going to try to separate you from your food or your money or whatever that might have been at the time. The mid-70s, late-70s found me living with a friend on his living room floor, and then, well, not the end of the 70s, at the end of the 70s, no, my friend, that was the 80s, sorry about that. By the end of the 70s, I was living in filth, and I was living in squalor. And in 1979, two wonderful friends pushed their way past the garbage, the pizza boxes, the candy wrappers, the filth, the cockroaches, the bugs, and everything else that was on my floor and in my life. If I made you live that way, they'd put me in prison. But they pushed past all that crap, and they took me to an OA meeting. Now, the way that they got me there was they had consorted with my wonderful friends who did two favors for me. They helped me, and they stopped. I don't know what was the greater favor. But these two people assured me that if I did not go to the meetings, that the money and all the friendship was going to come to a halt. That the jig was up. The end was there. And so I went to the meetings, reluctantly. I ate my way to the meetings. I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meetings. And I ate my way home. And for several years, I attended meetings of OA in Skokie and Evanston and on the north side of Chicago, where I'm from. And some things began to happen in my life. The first thing that began to happen is, for whatever reason, I stopped smoking. Now, I didn't come to OA to stop smoking. I didn't come here to do anything, but I didn't come here to stop smoking, but I did. The other things that started happening was I started losing weight. And that was a nice thing, too. Now, a strange thing happened to me in 1983. I graduated from OA. I floated right out the top. And after I floated out the top and I graduated from OA, my life started spiraling downward again very, very quickly and very horribly. And by April of 1983, I found myself in a hospital room in Skokie Valley Hospital at 513 pounds. And you know, you don't have to get to this point to know that the food had its grip on me from day one. The food absolutely controlled me, emasculated me, deformed me. It determined who I could be and who I could not be, where I could go and where I could not go. And I don't have to get that graphic for you to know that this was absolute hell. I'm not even going to go into the fact that the edema, the swelling in my lower extremities, was so profuse that I could not wear socks because I couldn't get them on. They would dig into me. I couldn't get them off, and they would get soaked because at the end I had nickel and dime size ulcers in the back of my legs where the pus would run out. And I could not lay flat in a bed and breathe because I was so fat, and there was so much fat on my chest that I could not breathe in a bed. My bed was broken anyway, and I slept on a broken couch. And when I would sleep on this broken couch, the circulation, because of the back of the legs being the main avenue for that to happen, was cut off because of the weight, and my ankles would blow up every night. I can tell you this because you're you. I can tell you this because you understand. The pain and the torture that I suffered from this illness is unbelievable, and yet I kept eating. I couldn't wear underwear. I had towels between the layers of flab. I had contact dermatitis. My skin was red and open and angry, and it hurt and it burned and it was horrible. And the towels would start to stink. And I had two shirts, and they had holes in the side where the arms would rub, and they'd have cigarette burns up and down the front. I smelled like a trip to the flippin' zoo. I couldn't wipe my rear end unless I had a wall to lean against. This disease had its way with me. And when we go through Bill's story a little bit later on, we're going to see on page 6, I believe, 7, alcohol was my master, Bill is going to tell us a little bit later on. Food was my master. It was Pharaoh. It ruled with an iron hand. And the walking bosses and the taskmasters were fear and resentment, jealousy, all these various things that would go through my mind all the time. Those were the taskmasters, the walking bosses. And that is how I lived. And yet there was that part of me that would do it again. You know, and today for sure, but I mean even then, if everybody would just leave me alone, I would have just continued to live that way because I didn't know anything else. There's a problem with having nickel and dime size ulcers on the back of your leg where the pus runs out. Infection can run in. And I got cellulitis and staph infection in my lower extremities, and they feared that I was going to be gangrenous. And they started to see some signs in my left leg. And on the day before Harold Washington was elected our mayor, this would be April the 13th or 14th of 83, I was admitted to Skokie Valley Hospital. My fever was 105, and they explained to me that if your fever gets to 108, you're done. You're done. And they told me that they thought that they were going to have to amputate my left leg. And I sat in that hospital, and they gave me a room upstairs, and I had the hospital gown on. And I can see that hospital gown. Now, I was 513 pounds running a fever, but I still have to laugh slash cry. The hospital gown looked like I was wearing a blue tie. It was blue and white, you know, those hospital gowns are like blue and white. I can see it now, and it looked like a tie that would just go down, and then the rest of me would be just sticking out like that. And on the medical chart, I guess for reasons which are known to them, they listed my weight as 513 pounds. It said on there, cellulitis, staph infection. Then there were some other things which I have no idea what they mean. And then at the bottom it said, this weight is not a mistake. This man is enormous. I guess they wanted to make sure that no one looked at that weight and said, no, that can't be right. Because it was right. Now here's how sick my brain was, and here's how sick my brain still is. Was my foot. I honestly thought this thought, you know, if I got down to 450, that's not too bad, right? I really thought that. Isn't that something? Now, something happened in that hospital, which I bet you have also done. I sat there and I prayed our national anthem. I said, God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. Please, I'll do anything you say, and I'll never eat like that again. And then what happened was I heard two very sweet words. Now, this was a Monday that I came in. Tuesday was the mayoral election. On Tuesday, a nurse came into my room after all the doubt that they were winning. You know, staph infection, cellulitis is viral. It's not bacterial, which means antibiotics don't do you any good. But they were throwing everything they could throw at this staph infection, cellulitis thing. And she came up to my room and she said, 99. The two sweetest words I've ever heard, 99. Unbelievable. That meant that they weren't... I said, you ain't cutting my leg off. I can tell you that right now. And what they did was working. God was yanking me out of the jaws of death. He was saving me. Because Lord knows everything I did would have killed me. Lord knows! Now, when you're hospitalized and your condition is morbid obesity and you're 513 pounds, it's kind of wrote into the insurance thing. They send up the nutritionist. And the advice, she weighed 94 pounds. The clipboard that she was carrying was heavier than her. And she comes into the room and she gave me advice that should have saved all of us. She told me, only eat half. Where have you been all my life, dear? Where have you been? She said, just eat half. And then the psychologist comes up. He weighs 134 pounds. And the pen weighs more than he does. And he comes up and he told me something that was fantastic. He's a psychologist and he said, why don't you do this? Let's say you want a new car. Keep a picture of the car. And every time you want to overeat, look at the picture of the car and think, if I overeat, I can't get the car. I said, man, you are a genius. Wow, what are they teaching you in that? Where did you go, like to Vienna or something for that? I says, man, you are... Because you don't know what else to tell them. You can't, as we're going to read in the big book later on a little bit this afternoon, I'm used to saying this morning, I had no explanation for what I was doing or why. I could no more explain to these people why I did these things than I could explain why today is Saturday. They were looking for intellectual reasons, cause and effect, why I was eating this way. And then the psychiatrist came up. And he told me the same thing, basically, that the psychologist, he says, just visualize yourself as thin, and you'll be thin, and you'll be wonderful, and Lassie will jump over the fence. It'll be fantastic, and then you'll hear the whistle, doo-doo, and then the dog will jump, and you'll have a great life. Anyway, all that stuff was fantastic. Now, I'll just show you how sick I was, not just mentally, but physically. I was in that hospital for 15 days, even in 1983. You know how sick you gotta to be in a hospital for 15 days? I'm having hip replacement surgery on October the 14th of this year. They already told me, Tuesday you're in, Friday you're out of here. Kick you in the street. So you know how sick you gotta to be in there for 15 days? Man, was I sick. They didn't amputate my leg. I still have a lot of discoloration. If you give me a dime later or a quarter, I'll let you see some of it. But I'm walking on my own legs. But this is a vicious, vicious illness. Now, something else happened that was kind of funny. I was really sick in there. 105 fever, not fun. Cellulitis, not fun. Staph infection, not fun. Don't want to eat anymore, right? I said to myself, I'm not going to eat this way anymore. I walked out of that hospital in April of 1983. There was about 2 inches of ice on that parking lot floor. Have you ever been in Chicago in April? See, you've never really been in Chicago unless you've used your air conditioner and your heater on the same day. You really haven't. You have not lived there. And if you live there, you've used your air conditioner and your heater on the same day. But in April, it can be winter-esque, or it can be hot as anything. Well, this was a cold morning. Now, one of the most beautiful side effects of morbid obesity is the dry skin. And you get the fissures, the cracking in your feet. It's a beautiful thing. And when my feet would crack, because I couldn't wear socks, and you know, my shoes, they needed replacing like 5 years before, but who's got money for shoes? I need money for candy. And the bottom line is, I'm walking out to the parking lot of the hospital, and I'm still singing the national anthem, and I get in the car, which hasn't been started for two weeks, and it starts, and I'm saying, oh, thank you, God. And I look in my wallet, I says, oh, I need gas. I need gasoline. There was a 10 and 2 fives. I can see them now. I can see the 10 and the 2 fives. And I put $3 worth of gas in there, and the other $17 before I got home from the hospital went for binge foods. I was eating before I went home. And I did not come up for air until 1986 at about 700. Now, when I came in 1986, I really knew that there was a home in OA. I knew that there was something there, but I was scared of you. I was frightened of you. I didn't want to be a part of you. And again, I don't know the reasons, and I don't know all the psychological situations, but I think that I feared being judged by you. I feared that you were going to somehow take away my food, because I sort of knew that that was part of the deal. I sort of kind of knew that at some point I was going to have to put down the food. And I had to want to put down the food. Let me say that again. I had to want to put down the food. I had to become willing to be willing. And I wasn't quite there yet. Even though my life was hell. Even though at the very end my food was getting very, very salty. Because I was living with my friend then. This was the 80s. And I'd be sitting in a chair on a Friday night, or on a Friday night would be a perfect example. And my friends would be going out and doing the things with girls that guys do. And I'd be sitting there, and I would have just gone out and bought half of a convenience store and brought it home. And for some reason, I would make a crazy deal with myself that tonight I was not going to eat that stuff. Tonight I was just going to sit with it, I'm just going to relax, and I'll eat some of it tomorrow. Some of it tomorrow. And all of a sudden I would go in there and I'd say, okay, I'll have a little. And something very, very strange would happen to a grown man that made my food very salty. Because as I was sitting there wanting to be my friends, as I was sitting there watching the Love Boat, or the Love American Style, or whatever was on Friday night, I think it was Love American Style or something, I would start to cry from the toes. Because I knew something was happening that I could not control. Because once I had started eating that stuff, something would come over me and I would say to myself, oh my God, stop, stop, don't do this, stop. And the next thing I knew, the next conscious breath I took, the food was gone. All that was left were licked and picked over containers. How could I have done this again? How could this be happening? Why can't I just have a few? Some. A little. Why can't I do that? And I came back and I started noticing things in the program that I had never noticed before. The first thing I started really noticing was that there was a way out from the hell I was living in. I didn't even want to see it before. I didn't care to see it before. I just sort of assumed when I got to a certain age that everything would be okay. That when I got to be 30 or 40, that I just wouldn't eat this way anymore, then that would be it. I just sort of assumed that because it was this year or that year, that everything would be okay. Or I assumed the other side of the coin, and I'll tell you what that is too. I inherited something from my mother. I wanted to die. I really did. People would say to me, you're going to die. I'd say, oh good. Not to them, but I'd say it to myself. I would just say, I know. Could you just let me know the time of the day so I'll make sure at least if I'm going to go, I'm going to go on a full stomach? Because I didn't know how to live. And I had tried what I thought was everything. And I did not know how to live in this world. And I felt myself unfit and unworthy. Because this is not a world for people in that kind of pain. At some point, I have to say to myself, I want out. And so something very strange happened. Somebody very mercifully pointed out something I had read and heard a lot of times. It's called Step Zero. Now, it's not in the book as Step Zero, but it's Step Zero, and it's on page 58 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Because in my life, I was miserable. In my life, it was a hell with the food. I was either eating or not eating. I could not begin to control my cravings once I had started. And they explained to me when I came in that that's because of something we're going to be talking about a little later on. We're going to be talking about the doctor's opinion. We're going to go through the doctor's opinion and we're going to see a word in there, allergy. And people would say to me, you have an allergy. And I'd say, what are you talking about? They'd say, you can't eat pizza. You're allergic. And I'd say, I'm allergic. I'm eating 7 football fields of pizza each week. I'm not sneezing. I'm not itching. I'm not coughing. I'm not breaking out in hives. What are you talking about allergic? And they'd say, you can't eat it because you can't stop. An allergy, as we're going to find out a little later, is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. And if 9 out of 10 people reacted to the pizza the way my friends did, having a piece and being done, and 1 out of 10 people reacts the way I do, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, and it becomes endless, then I'm considered to be allergic because my reaction is considered to be abnormal. Now there's nothing, as we're going to find out a little later, there's nothing OA or anybody can do about an allergy. But what if I could find a way to live where I don't set up the mental obsession, which is the other side of this illness, and we're going to talk about that too. What if I could find a way to live where my brain will not lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food? Because they also told me I have something called a mental obsession. And an obsession is a thought which pushes aside all thoughts to the contrary. That I think about food differently than other people, and I react to food differently than other people. What if I could find a way to live where I already feel better, and my mind won't need to lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes instantaneously upon eating the food? And that process of feeling better is called recovery. Now, what is it that I'm going to need to do? What is it that I need to do to get this recovery? And somebody very mercifully pointed out about 3,000 miles from here, in a place that I love very much called Chicago, they pointed something out to me that's in the foreword to the big book of alcohol, or the preface to the big book of the Alcoholics Anonymous, not the foreword, but the preface to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he explained to me, you keep hearing about the promises on page 83, and I'm going to be talking a lot about this today, even to the ones that are asleep by now. But for the ones that are awake, I'm going to be talking about this, because in the preface to the fourth edition and in the preface to the book, it says, this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery. There exists strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth edition. The section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late William D. Soapworth. That means that these people think that this book is so pure that they have never found it necessary to change it. A little later on, we're going to find two words and one thing that has been changed in the book. In the 12th step, it used to say in the very first edition, first volume, it used to say spiritual experience, and today it says spiritual awakening. And we're going to find out a little bit about that later. But what that's telling me is that this book does not need me or anyone to change it. And in the foreword to the first edition, he also pointed out, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Once again, this is not the work of one person. This is the work of the culmination of 100 men and women. And it's telling me that this is the basic text, that there are going to be things I'm going to have to do. There's going to be direction. There's going to be directives. We hear this in OA, this lie in OA. There's no must in OA. Well, the word must appears in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous 72 times. And there are going to have to be some things I'm going to must have to do. And one of the things I'm going to have to do is to follow the directions. Now, John K. was good enough to come and pick me up when I landed at the Burbank Airport today. I landed there this morning, and John picked me up from the airport. And me and John were in the car, and we were coming over here. Now, me and John are both compulsive overeaters. Do I speak for you on that? Okay. We're both compulsive overeaters, see? But what if we said to each other, or he's driving, what if he says, screw that map, because he had a map with him. Screw that map. We're not doing that. The map says we're going to go south on that street. Screw that. I'm going north. And then there was a place where we had to make a left turn. He said, screw that. I'm making a right turn. Heck with them. We'd be somewhere. But I wonder how close to this place we'd be right now if we got there just based on our own volition and our own wanton desire to go in any direction we so choose. But in order to get here now, we had to follow those directions or we wouldn't be where we want to be, and that's a very hard one for me to follow. I don't like being told what to do. But in the forward to the second edition, there's something else that reinforces this and drives the point home again. It says on page XX, or page 20, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, excuse me, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings, and at first they decided they didn't want the program, but great numbers of these, about two of three, began to return as time passed. Now, I'm not a math whiz by any stretch of the imagination, but that sounds to me like 75% recovery. And of the remaining 25%, they potchkied in, they potchkied out, they showed improvement. Now, I have no idea what meetings are like here in wherever we are. Glendale, California. I have no idea what your meetings are like. I bet they are. But I do know what meetings are like in Chicago, and I know what meetings are like in Phoenix, and I know what meetings are like in Scottsdale, Arizona. We can't talk about 75% recovery. We can't talk about 50% recovery. We can't talk about 10% recovery. What we can talk about realistically is about 1.5% to 2% on the high side of the people that are stumbling through the door of OA that are recovering. Our recovery rates are abysmal compared to these numbers. Abysmal, because we are getting away from the big book of AA. When I am looking for recovery in any other way, I am trying to buy a tuxedo at the hardware store. This book, this is the directions. There's lots of other stuff out there. It's great information. Some of it is very poignant. Some of it is not. If I want to recover, I'm talking about me now, I'm not preaching. If I want to recover, I'm going to have to do it out of the big book. And I'm going to have to follow its directions. And I'm going to have to do what it says. And then right before, because we're going to take a little potty break here, I'm going to leave you on this thought. I believe, and we're going to get into the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and we're going to go through everything. I believe that God wrote the book. The reason that I believe that God wrote the book are many, but among the reasons that I believe that God wrote the book is the human being who penned it did not know enough to write it. He had 3.5 years of sobriety at the time. He was not a spiritual giant. He was not anything. He was another drunk. I believe that God wrote the book for another very important reason, and that is this. In the 7,000-year history of gluttony, alcoholism, addiction in the 7,000 years of recorded history of addiction, this book, this set of directions that I'm holding in my hand, and many of you have too, has worked more than all other methods combined. This direction, this book, has restored more families and put more people back on the path of a productive life than all other methods put together. And that's why I believe that this is one of the most important pieces of spiritual literature ever written. Let's take a 5-minute potty break.